listening to KBOO Portland.
Reverend Jeremiah Wright Jr., you're tuned in to Hard Rock Radio.
No, Hard Knock. Just say this hard is knock. Yeah, Hard Knock. Hard yeah, knock. So you just got to say this is Reverend Jeremiah Wright.
This is Reverend
and Jeremiah Wright, no, and you're listening to Hard Knock Radio.
Yo. This is Reverend Jeremiah Wright. You're tuned in to Hard Knock. Yo, keep it real, right? You know what I'm saying?
Wait, one more time, because they are not gonna believe it was you.
This is Reverend Jeremiah Wright Jr., and you're tuned in to Hard Knock. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for your support. God bless you.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. I wanted to alert you to something that's actually going on right now as you are hearing my voice, and this is a gathering of people who are down at Clay Street to deal with what is happening in education. In particular, it's a solidarity march and gathering, and how we can manage to bring resources together, and how we are looking at a police-free school system. Joining us on the line is one of the people that's behind the organizing of this. Her name is Becca. Becca, welcome to the show. And I didn't get your last name before we talked, so you could just introduce yourself to our audience.
Yeah, my name is Becca Rosso Marsh, and I'm a teacher at CCPA. I've been there 10 years, and I'm a parent of a first grader at Greenleaf Elementary. Thank you for having me on the show.
What's happening today at 4?
So today we are holding a rally, an art event, and a car caravan, and the title of our rally is Educators for Black Sanctuary. We are holding this event in solidarity with Black Organizing Project and with the George Floyd resolution to have police-free schools in OUSD. We are the only school district in Alameda County that has its own police force, which means that education dollars are going, about $3 million education dollars are going every year to pay to have uniformed and armed officers in our schools. And Black Organizing Project has written this resolution, has been campaigning for almost 10 years now to have police-free schools and to have Black sanctuary for Black students and for all students.
Let me ask you this. Are you surprised that this campaign has been going on for this long?
I'm not surprised. Really, it's amazing that in this moment, there is lots of energy and there's lots of possibility around really passing this resolution, but it comes from 10 years of hard work, and there hasn't been a lot of support. And we know the kind of presence and impact that police have in our communities, and those police that are on the streets are also in our schools and continue to have the same impact. And so although there's been so much pushback, there's been a lot of resistance from the administration at school sites. There's been a lot of resistance from the district in what seems like a very reasonable ask that our schools be safe for students, be places of safety and of learning and of care and of love and not of fear and of policing.
As a teacher, how have your students reacted to the presence of police on campus? And it seems like a simple question on one hand, but it's also very layered on another. Many of us grew up, you know, being taught that the police are there to protect and serve, and, you know, they would come to the class and do show and tell and hang out and, you know, and do that sort of thing, at least when I was a student. And it seemed like over the years, younger and younger students have had a fear of police. I run into kids who are fearful of them. So as a teacher for 10 years, how have you seen the students react to the presence of police?
Yeah, and I mean, this makes me think of my son also, my 6-year-old son, who's about to be in first grade, also fears police, especially when we're in our car with undocumented family members. he gets like visibly scared. And so there is a way that, yes, I feel in my students and I feel in my own family. I feel like often I've seen our school having to be to protect students from the impact of police. And yes, I mean, there are individual officers that occasionally have come and have had like decent relationships with certain students. But overall, I think having police present on campus then also trains all adults on campus to use police as solutions for issues that have nothing to do with police. Like if we have a student that is having a mental health crisis, if we have a student that potentially is harming themselves, the fact that the protocol is to contact police or that is like the closest way to get safety, that impacts the experience of students, but it also kind of trains the ways that adults on campus operate. And so part of getting rid of having cops in schools is, yes, there's all sorts of crises and challenges that happen in schools, but we can create other safety plans that have nothing to do with cops.
Real talk right there. You know, that's interesting that you noted that their presence leads to many teachers and administrators moving in their direction and not the other way around. What has often happened in the past is we've been sold on the idea that a particular type of policing would take place in school. These would be officers who are trained in mental health scenarios, who would know how to do counseling, because these are the roles that, you know, theoretically speaking, adults who are present on a campus have to play. You become a role model, you become a counselor, you know, you become a confidant, you know, for kids who are troubled at home. You become a multiple array of things other than just being a teacher or an administrator. But it seems like, you know, we were told the police were going to move in that direction, but from my standpoint, from what I'm hearing, that hasn't happened. You all have moved in the direction, not them.
And I think, again, like, maybe there are individual instances of that, but then, and like, if what we ultimately want is someone who can support around mental health or counseling or restorative justice, then those should be the people we're investing in, the people who have that training. And as opposed to having people who have police training and then trying to make them adjust to a school environment and be able to be caring in their police roles. If we want, and this is, you know, we know that a lot of the issues that come up in our schools come from a lack of fundamental resources. So part of it is like, why are the resources going to the police? And we could do trainings, but if ultimately what we want is those mental health supports, we want the restorative justice, we want something based in real long-term health and safety, then let's put the resources there.
What do you find is the biggest need as a teacher that you need in schools right now? What is being cut? What could some of this money actually fulfill if you don't have a police force there?
I would defer to the Black Organizing Project, and everyone can go to their website, has a really solid plan around safety and around where that money would go to. A lot of it, and I don't have the plan in front of me right now, so I don't want to speak to it in an incorrect way, but generally it's going to having restorative justice to resolve conflicts and to address harm in a deep way and to keep students in school and keep students engaged with each other and connected to their communities. Additional mental health supports. Often, at our school, we already have maybe a third of our students are receiving mental health services in some way, and there are always people who can't get on, there are always students who can't get on the caseloads, or students that can only be seen every couple weeks, and there are certain students who need it way more. I think there's been huge cuts around counselors, around mental health, around, there's not enough funding restorative justice, there's a mandate around restorative justice, but to really do that well, you need a lot of staff, and that staff needs to be trained and needs to be compensated. There's also been huge cuts around arts, around music, around sport, around other things that make us healthy. And I think that that's part of, and that has been cut incredibly in the last 10 and 20 years.
As we close out, Becca, you know, we're talking to you actually before this rally. People hearing it now, the rally is going on. So can you explain to people exactly what will be happening, how they can join you during this hour, or how long it's going to be lasting, and if people are nearby, where they can meet up with you all at?
Yes. From 4 until 5:30, we will be at 1000 Broadway downtown, and you can join in car and do a car caravan that's going to be going around the block. You can get out of your car and park and participate in the chalk art and listen to speakers. We're going to have amazing speakers there, from principals to students to teachers, and the united voice of educators and the education system saying we are willing to do the work and we wanted the work to have our schools be police-free zones. And we know that it's on us as educators to also do that work. And it's on administrators to do that work too. But the time has already passed. The fact that there are police in schools is not acceptable to us. And so we need to do the work to have schools that don't need cops. I told that to my kid. I'm like, we're going to this rally today, my six-year-old. And I was like, I want you for the next 10 years of your school life to never have to see a police officer in your school. And so we want people to come out, if wear a mask, wear a black shirt, or wear your Oakland Education Association shirt if you have one. And the board is going to vote on this resolution on Wednesday with Black Organizing Project. And so we'll keep people posted on that.
Yes, and we're definitely going to be talking with them as well to get further detail about that vote on Wednesday. But right now, if you're listening, you can go down to 1000 Clay Street. What is that cross street when we're talking about Clay Street?
1000 Broadway.
Thank you. I'm glad you caught that. 1000 Broadway. There we go. I would have sent people to the wrong address.
We'll be close by. But yeah, it's 1000 Broadway and 11.
There we go. Will people just be gathered around there, or will they be going to a particular location, or that's the beginning and end of the rally?
That's where we'll be. There will be certain contingents that are going to caravans afterwards that are different locations, so you can get information there about where to go next. But our main meeting point is 1000 Broadway. We're also going to have a live radio broadcast, 88.3. So you can tune in to 88.3. FM to hear the speakers.
There you have it. Want to thank you, Becca, for joining us this afternoon. We will be on the lookout for this. We'll keep people posted about the vote on Wednesday with the Black Organizing Project, and to see how we can get Oakland schools to be police free. So with that being said, thank you very much. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
This is Danny Glover, and I want you to listen to what I listen to. Hard Knock Radio.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Want to continue our conversation about defunding, having a school free of police. And you've heard their names mentioned often, the Black Organizing Project. And one of the people who we had the pleasure of hearing speak, maybe about a week or so, we played a sound clip from her, is Jessica Black from the Black Organizing Project. So, Jessica, first of all, welcome to the show. And second of all, 10 years you all have been at this. Why has it taken 10 years to really get, first of all, a vote on whether or not schools should have police, and even just to have this conversation be front and center in the way that it is now?
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons. You know, when we first started off, people really did not even want to be connected with BOP because they thought that our demands were too radical. So we had to take a chip at the paradigm. We had to change people's minds around what safety actually meant. So we were able to do reforms in the beginning. When we went into the school system, we realized that there was a police department, there was the city police who were in the schools under a COPS grant, and the security and unarmed security officers. With the police officers, there was nothing to describe or define their role. So we created a board policy for Oakland School Police Department to define their role, and also for Oakland Police Department. Inside of those policies, what we started to do was we implemented tracking systems so that we could see what interaction is actually happening, how many phone calls are being made, who's being arrested, and why they're being arrested, and disaggregated by race, disability, age, and gender.
What did you find in that report?
Say it again.
What did you all find in that report or that tracking?
The tracking is still happening. What we know now is that black students make up 26% of the student population in Oakland and 73% of the arrests.
What do you say to people that go, well, you know, Jessica, black people, they just, you know, they commit more crimes? You often hear people kind of counter that sort of revelation. What do you say in response to that?
It's not true. There's nothing to back that up. It's not factual at all. In fact, what it is just like the ideology. It's the police department is rooted, like if you look at the origins and the history of police, it's rooted in anti-blackness. That is where this came from. And so when people are walking around with that same mindset, that they have adopted this narrative that has been imposed on us in this current society, which is not true. And, you know, this fight is really a political fight. And it's a fight for humanity, for people to see our children as humans, more or less than beasts and savages. Most of that thinking comes from that place. And what we're aiming to do at BOP is not only decriminalize education, dismantle the school-to-prison pipeline, but we also have to dismantle that ideology. When we break down those calls for service that are actually happening on school sites and we look at what those calls are for, those calls to service that go to school sites are not, the majority of them are not for violent things at all. They're for things like stand by and preserve the peace. What does that mean? Criminalizing things happen when students have childlike behavior. So-and-so took my cell phone. What happened to peer-to-peer mediation? What happened to adults stepping in and teaching students social skills? Like, how can you get along with one another? And there's sometimes in the world where you're not going to get along with each other, but you can respect each other. Those components are missing from the school system currently. And so what is happening is the answer is to call the police, and the answer is to criminalize students. And we're fighting back against that narrative.
So, you know, so to kind of break it down, this has been my observation. You tell me if I'm wrong. I go into a school in Oakland and I see four or five kids. They're joking around. Teachers trying to teach, they're talking, you look and you say, these damn kids need to, you know, pay attention. Now, mind you, these kids are in first or second grade, but you hear, like, they're not listening, and this is why they're headed for jail. I go to a school in Marin County, or maybe down on the peninsula, and it's white or Asian kids there, and they're joking around, and you know, they're not listening to the teacher. And the response to it is that they are future leaders. They're very spirited. We need to nurture them and really refocus that energy. And so am I wrong in my observation in terms of, like, the same behavior is seen drastically different when it is the race of the person that you're talking to?
You are not wrong. That has been our experience. With many of the parents, students who are a part of BOP have had those experiences. Is that oftentimes, you know, any behavior coming from our children, good or bad, for instance, we ended up passing a willful defiance policy that basically says that students can be suspended for things like rolling their eyes or chewing gum. Those are all ways that students were getting criminalized. And so we got that policy passed actually from kindergarten all the way through 12th grade, because we think the influx of students being pushed out for actually just being them and I would say for cultural, like cultural misunderstandings, right? So there's cultural relevant pedagogy that exists in education and is underutilized and undertaught inside of the academic institutions. Therefore, you typically have younger European folks coming into the school systems not understanding culturally, not understanding the diversity within our community. And so if a child is rolling their eyes, all of a sudden that gets looked at like a criminal act instead of an opportunity to develop a relationship with that child.
Real talk right there. And so I just chalk it up to people being afraid of our folks and not willing to have a different type of conversation. So when I hear people say defund the police in the schools, the question that often comes up, what's going to be the replacement? What happens if so-and-so, if there's a fight? What happens if you have a problem student? What are the plans? Because they say that you all have spent a lot of time thinking about this and developing these alternatives, quote-unquote alternatives.
Mm-hmm. So a couple of things. One is that we're not calling for a defunding of the police. We are calling for an elimination of the Oakland Unified School Police Department. And so a lot of school districts have contracts. We'll be the first in this country that has eliminated an entire school police department with a resolution that is rooted in police-free schools. And so we know that things happen because that's what children do. But that's why we're calling for restorative justice practices. We're calling for trauma-induced services, more school counselors, vocational services. Some students are like, they don't want to go right into a four-year college. They just want to take a trait. We're calling for all of these things to be preventative measures. The police don't actually prevent these things. Police come after the fact. But it's all about the environment in which you set for the children. So the current way and the current structure that is set as if the students are criminals. That's why you have police, and that's why you have all the levels of policing that exist in Oakland Unified School District present. We're saying, no, put these things to build up on their social and emotional skills. Put that component back in schools. It doesn't mean that a school fight won't happen, but what it does mean is that there'll be a principled way to teach students how to get along or how to deal in an environment where you don't necessarily like somebody, but the principality of respect exists.
Right. And if something really violent was to happen, you have the city police anyway, which they would, I'd say, intervene the same way they would with anything else within the city. So it's not like for those who are very, you know, concerned that there wouldn't be police somewhere around. But we're talking about immediately when you walk into a campus, you're not dealing with, you know, police. And we just talked to teachers that, you know, and I've talked to plenty, who say that kids get triggered and it's no longer the relationship of, oh, that's the friendly officer. It's usually a lot of times it's like they're afraid.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. A couple of things. One is we're actually calling for no contracting with law enforcement. And I challenge people to think about it like this. You don't see the fire department sitting on every corner waiting for the call for the fire. And so we shouldn't do that with the police when it comes to our children either. Now, the city does have a responsibility. I mean, Oakland Unified School District is the only school district in Alameda County that has a police department. And of course, the city has a responsibility to respond to emergencies, not to some of the things that they are being called for right now.
Right. So you don't call the police because the first grader is talking back to the teacher.
Exactly.
And that has happened.
You don't call the police because two first graders got into a fight or two 12th graders got into a fight. You don't necessarily need to call the police for that. So that's why we are calling for this repurposing of the SSOs. Many of those folks come from Black and brown communities, and the restructuring of that and have roots in the community. And so in this inclusive collective process, this community-driven process that we're going to put together, there's going to be a restructuring to have like mentors on school campuses. People who are in tune with the families, people who are in tune with the communities, people who have relationships with the students.
And that's the key to it all. Wednesday is going to be the big vote. How is it looking? What do you want people to do?
What we would like for people to do on Wednesday is to definitely watch the school board meeting, call into the school board meeting, but also get ready. What we really want people to know is that Wednesday it's looking good, but you never know until we get there, so we have to continue to apply the pressure from the community, which the community has done such an amazing job at that. But Wednesday, get ready for the next fight, because we win the resolution if the school board votes in favor of it, and then there's the implementation phase. And we're talking about a community-driven process, which also means community control, which means that the system then not only has to change the culture and climate in the classroom, they have to change the culture and climate in how they deal with community.
Well, that's real.
You can't go create something and you bring it to us, because we are co-creating and co-designing a process.
What time does the meeting start, Jessica?
The meeting starts at, we should be heard right at 4:30 is when it starts. They come back from closed session, so usually about 4:45 they get started.
So that's Wednesday, 4 o'clock, 4:30. You can check it out on Zoom, the school board meeting. Jessica from the Black Organizing Project, Jessica Black, thank you for joining us. Is there a number or a website?
Yes, we are at www.blackorganizingproject.org. Also check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Black Organizing Project.
So there you have it. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Whoop, whoop.
Yo, this is M1 from Dead Press.
Hey, what's up? This is Boots from the Coup.
Nah, I mean, telling you to stay tuned to Hard Knock Radio.
Keep it locked.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. All eyes are on the city of Seattle, and it's a city that is unique. It's a city with a long history of resistance, and it's a city that is innovative in the way that it approaches things. Most of us know Seattle from the Battle of Seattle, but in between that time, there's been a lot of movement that has happened. Some of it has made the news, some of it has not. Joining us on the phone line is Greg Lewis, longtime activist, freedom fighter, somebody who's no stranger to dealing with police accountability. And we want to look at what is happening right now with a formation that they're calling the CHOP, the takeover of several blocks. But I wanted to talk to Greg because of the history that leads up to this. So, Greg, how you doing, brother?
I'm good. Good to hear from you.
Let's give people a Seattle 101. And, you know, I want to look at it really with a black perspective. We know about the Battle of Seattle, and many people have this perception that it's just black, it's just white folks. But there's been a lot of black activity that has been very crucial to this moment. So can you give us a little bit of a walkthrough that you think we should know?
Well, right off the top, you definitely want to go back before my time, and that's that the Seattle chapter of the Black Panther Party was the first chapter outside the state of California, and it was formed right here in Seattle, Washington, under the leadership of Aaron and Elmer Dixon. They actually got the charter to form the chapter here at little Bobby Hutton's funeral. So that's, you know, I want to preface it with that, because even before me, there is resistance happening here. When before them, when Marcus Garvey went on his tour, he spoke in Seattle in two places, and he had to book a second location because the other one was standing remotely, and there was people outside still wanting to hear him. You know, and this was back in the 1920s, you know, the teens and the 20s, you know, when Marcus Garvey came through here. You know, so there's already a long history. Dr. King, of course, he visited here, you know, shortly after the formation of the Black Panther Party. And, you know, he was here, you know, offering his support for desegregation efforts. We can fast forward to the 80s, where Omari Tahir and other folks were blocking And keep in mind, they were not only blocking a police precinct being built in the black community, which historically has been the central area, but they had already come off a successful boycott of Safeway, who were selling fish from then apartheid South Africa, to the point where the Safeway had to close down. This was in the 70s when they closed it down, and it didn't reemerge until the late 2000s back in the central area. So after they'd done that successfully, they then, you know, got word that a precinct was going to be put up at 23rd and Yesler, and, you know, there was a house there, and they were just going to take it, make it into a museum and cultural center, and the police backed down and ended up moving the precinct over to 12th and Pine, where it exists now, and the activists went on to go take the Coleman School, which had been shut down by the school district. And then after a long struggle that around that I joined in the 90s, then it eventually became what we now know as the Northwest African American Museum. So there's already, and then on top of that, just received word that K.Y. King Garrett, who is Omari Tahir's son, just got word from the city that the fire station they decided to put at the spot there on 23rd and East Yesler is now going to be a black cultural center. Of course, the details got to be worked out amongst all the parties, but that's a piece of news that just came out yesterday.
Wow, and that's just even part of the story. When we first met, you know, you were part of a group in, I want to say not Third Eye, but it's, why am I forgetting the name? The rap group. Help me out on that, Greg, and forgive me for having a...
Dread Eye, yeah.
Dread Eye, thank you. But you all had your confrontations with the police, and there's always been this resistance with the police, both with black folks individually and sometimes teaming up with, you know, with the skinheads that were anti-racist. So can you talk a little bit about that history of racial resistance?
Oh, man. Well, what, you know, as I tell people, you know, and I preface a lot of what I say with, I, too, am a survivor of police terrorism. I mean, the only thing that separates me from George Floyd is I'm a little bit older than him, and I survived my encounter. My encounter happened in September of 1998 when I was attacked at me and Merciful Allah, also of Dread Eye, we were helping out at a car accident, and the police came, threw him on the hood of the car without asking any kind of questions whatsoever, no kind of investigation. You know, that's, you know, all, you know, white cop, all black crowd. When his black partner, Officer Williams, you know, came and defused the situation by asking questions, getting the information, Martin, the white cop, continued to be aggressive, and he went for my throat, and using, you know, self-defense skills that I've learned, you know, that I've been learning, you know, and now teach since the time I was 7, I was able to successfully defend myself against that police officer. Of course, I wound up in court for that, and I was facing a 10-year sentence. You know, and interestingly, the county wasn't prosecuting me. It was the city that was prosecuting me. So I went to court. We were found not guilty. And then we turned around and sued them. And, you know, we went through mediation. We went through a jury trial. Then we went through a second round of mediation after we got a hung jury. All but one of the jurors was willing to give us $2.2 million for our trauma in that case. And in 2002, we wound up settling for $30,000 apiece plus court costs.
Are you surprised after all that, from the Panthers to the time that you defended yourself to the Battle of Seattle, all that sort of stuff, that we're at this moment right now with the police?
You know what? Honestly, I'm not surprised at all. I mean, you know, we dinged them pretty hard, you know, with our lawsuit and several lawsuits after that happened, many after that happened. Also, a couple of inquests happened after that point, and they still didn't get the message. In fact, here we are under federal consent decree, and they're still not getting the message, and to the point where only recently did Mayor Durkin finally, you know, and the police, the head of the Seattle Police Officers Guild, those two finally stopped fighting the people, the public, as well as the federal government on, you know, the oversight piece. They were trying to water it down. They were trying to, you know, get certain pieces taken out of it, you know, in particular, you know, the qualified immunity and stuff like that. And only after the people took the streets and, you know, not only just peaceably, but also the folks who went ahead and punished some of these businesses, punished the police vehicles. Only after that did they finally stop fighting the federal, you know, all the details of the federal consent decree. And now they're talking about, well, we're going to fully, you know, go along with them. And on top of that, one of the things that isn't mentioned is that the ACLU filed a successful injunction against the use of tear gas, rubber bullets, flashbangs, and so on against protesters. It was only after that that the Seattle Police Chief Carbon Best then said, well, you know what, we're not going to use those things anymore. And only after that did the Seattle City Council unanimously say, yeah, we're against all of that, and we're going to go ahead and tell the police department that we're not going to allow tear gas, flashbangs, pepper spray, as well as chokeholds upon protesters, or in fact upon anybody. So that, you know, all those things were significant, you know, that it would, and what it took was mass action in the street, you know, both, you know, super confrontational as well as more passive and peaceful. You have to have both. It's a dichotomy. It works like pistons. You know, one piston goes up, the other one goes down, and vice versa. It's not just one side, as, you know, contrary to what, you know, some people will say.
Right.
You know, you really do have to have both. And on top of that, you also have the lawyers in the background working their magic as well, you know, and as well as, you know, other activists. You know, Nikita Oliver comes to mind. Julie C. comes to mind. She, of course, she's still in the mix. And, you know, of course, Omari, he's still out there doing what he's doing, even though he's, you know, a little over 70 now. You know, he's still, you know, making moves and getting in there and really walking place to place and talking face to face with people to get them involved and to really explain what the issues are and to go beyond the spin of Fox News, local right-wing outlets like Como 4, as well as, you know, straight-up alt-right folks like the Proud Boys and people like that, who have their own little goofy media that they put their stuff through, and then they show up, they'll do things like, you know, attach GoPros to themselves, show up at the protest, and then try to, you know, instigate fights. In fact, there's video floating around right now on the Twitter for the John Brown Gun Club, where members of the Proud Boys actually jump out of a van and beat a white man and steal his phone. You know, so that's strong arm robbery. And one of the people involved is a guy named Tiny Toulouse, if I get his last name right. He's the big Samoan who is notorious for stomping people out from that group. And he's currently facing assault charges in Oregon. So, of course, we have to question, why is he crossing state lines to assault people and effectively strong arm rob them? You know, we have to ask that question, especially in light of that video that just came out.
Wow. And there's a long history, of course, of those type of groups showing up in the Northwest. I think you told me, said that for a long time, that was a haven for, like, a lot of these supremacist groups.
To this day, they still have their little annual gathering over on Whidbey Island in celebration of Robert Matthews, who was the head of a terrorist organization known as The Order. And they had they assassinated radio talk show host Alan Berg, who was out of Denver. And then after that, they came to the Northwest, and they were out here robbing armored cars in order to fund their movement. He wound up being holed up in a house on Whidbey Island and shot it out with the FBI. The FBI, of course, set fire to the house. You know, does that sound familiar? Ruby Ridge, et cetera. And he died in the fire. And to this day, neo-Nazis travel from literally all over the world every year to Whidbey Island to celebrate that event, or to commemorate that event, I should say.
How do you all deal with that directly and have the police... Do the police work with them? And I'm asking this just knowing what went on in New Mexico with the shooting that took place the other day, and we're now looking at the radio transcripts from the calls, and they refer to those armed militia as armed friendlies. These are people that they work with. Did you find that the police up in the Pacific Northwest work a lot with these neo-Nazi type groups?
Oh, it's worse than that. I mean, not only do they work with them, some of them are actually members. Some of them hide their tattoos from these different groups, like your 3%ers and whatnot. Even worse than that, you know, and I'm still appalled by this, and very few people talk about it, is when the Proud Boys, Patriot Prayer, and other groups showed up at City Hall on not one but two separate occasions doing an armed carry protest. The first time they did it was in the name of an anti-Muslim rally. That's what they called it. And they were on City Hall property. Now, in this city, it is illegal to carry a gun anywhere on any city property or park unless you're law enforcement. And so how these guys managed to get a permit to do this, because they did get a permit, is really beyond me, especially when we have, you know, folks like Shama Sawant and Teresa Mosqueda on the city council. You know, I'm still shocked and amazed that these folks were able to get a permit to effectively have an armed hate rally. Meanwhile, when the counter demonstrators, your, you know, anti-fascists, people from the different socialist and communist parties, anarchists, other concerned people, concerned progressives, generally show up to counter-demonstrate, they're pushed across the street, literally pushed across the street, pepper sprayed, beaten without just cause, arrested. I mean, there's a long history of that, and this is something that, you know, a lot of progressive Seattle really doesn't like to talk about. You know, they'll talk about it in the context of protests that they attend, but they generally don't speak on it, you know, within the context of, you know, who gets a permit and who can protest where and when. I mean, I go back to the days of Occupy. I mentioned Julie C. She actually went and got a permit, had a rally at Westlake, and just as she was introducing everybody and opening the event, the police came and just started snatching people's signs, talking about, oh, these are dangerous weapons and threatening arrest and everything else. And this was back in 2011. You know, fast forward to just a couple years ago, and, you know, somehow, as if by magic, it's okay for the alt-right to come, you know, rocking, you know, full, you know, bandoliers and extra clips of ammunition and, you know, assault rifles and everything else, and parading around on city property with police protection. You know, shameful.
Let me ask you this, Greg. If we know the police are in the ranks, or the supremacists are in the ranks of the police, how do you look at this debate or this discussion around defunding, abolishing, or reforming? What direction do you think people need to take when dealing with the police, understanding the history that you laid out?
Well, when we're talking about defunding the police, the only real way you can defund them is through reparations, self-determination, you know, workplace democracy, and a global economy based upon the principle of from each according to ability to each according to need. That's how you really get rid of it. Right now, at best, you can have funding shifted from, say, weaponry to more social services and crisis, you know, crisis response teams, which is great in the short term. You know, that's fantastic in the short term. And as somebody who works in permanent supportive housing, I'm absolutely supportive of that, since a lot of, you know, our tenants, they are mentally ill and so on. And a lot of them have been traumatized by the police. A lot of them have been brutalized by the police. One of the things that people don't like to talk about too much is how much this happens to the homeless and how it's very underreported. So in the short term, that's great, but at any deal, but again, it still keeps the impetus for any of these reforms firmly in the hands of the people who are objectively part of the problem, you know? And so, you know, for me, you know, based upon my experience, my studies of history, my studies of current policy, I'm looking for that. The only demand that I have for any of these folks is their unconditional surrender. You know, Jenny Durkin needs to resign. A whole bunch of people on the city council need to resign. And we really need to have real power in the hands of real people in a very real way. You know, I saw it when I went to Chiapas and when I went to Oaxaca. In particular, Oaxaca, I was at a town there where everybody has to do, you know, police service in order to, for 1 year in order to graduate high school. By law, you have to be born there. People have to know your family. And most of your job is not really policing. Most of your job is literally helping people. So, you know, when I was down there, one of the things that I saw was that a guy was super inebriated and he fell down a cliff. And the police, in their little truck, they showed up and they came with a backboard and a winch. And they went down there and they pulled him up out of there, took him to the hospital. And then I was talking to the neighbors and they said, oh, yeah, well, what they're going to do is they're going to call the family and the family's going to come down and see about it. And they also have programs there for getting people off of alcohol, because in Oaxaca, you know, just like indigenous communities all over the world, alcohol and illicit drugs and even some prescription drugs are a huge problem, in those communities. So rather than, just the iron fist and throwing people in jail and all that stuff, here in a small town in Oaxaca called Uapum, they're actually putting in work and doing it as a community to help people rather than to punish them.
That's real.
That was a quality difference that I saw. Also, when I stayed amongst the EZLN, the Zapatistas, their approach was very much the same. And in fact, in their territories, they ban alcohol and drugs of any kind because it negatively affects women and children. And I strongly, suggest that your listeners go ahead and look up the Zapatistas, and in particular their revolutionary laws on women, which was laws written by women talking about these specific things among many, many others. And that's where they get their inspiration and their impetus and their need and desire to do something other than just, again, with the iron fist all the damn time.
Right. Greg, let me ask you this. The current thing that they have, the Central District Autonomous Zone, how should we take that? And is there a trajectory of that? People taking over, because you talked about self-determination, and from the outside looking in, that seems to be something that's headed in that direction.
Well, first of all, it's called the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. They recently changed the name to the Capitol Hill Occupy Protest.
What did I say? Central District? I said Central District. Okay, Capitol Hill. Sorry about that.
Yeah. I mean, it would be nice if it spread to the Central District. I'll be the first one to encourage it. But right now it's just on Capitol Hill. And the reason, one of the reasons it came about that way is because that's where the police lined up trying to stop the march coming from downtown, and they basically put up barricades around their precinct. Over time, they eventually withdrew from the precinct after throwing up fencing and boards over everything, and it's basically as a concession to the protesters. Because the thing is that the city, county, and state they know they're in the wrong here. They really do. There's a long history of police terrorism and brutality in the Pacific Northwest. And as somebody who survived my encounter, I can totally, concur with all that. Really what it is, from what I've seen and, my time up in there, it's a lot of participatory democracy, a lot of art, a lot of grieving, a lot of pain, a lot of people trying to find ways to express their pain and their outrage in creative ways that are nonviolent, for one. Also, something that, again, I go back to that participatory democracy because many people don't really have a lot of, tangible political power in their hands, even in their own daily lives. It isn't just enough just to vote for, it's like we got Trump, the sexual predator versus Biden, the sexual predator, and we should vote for one or the other and then just go home and go back to watching Netflix. And that's not, for a lot of these folks, are under the age of 30. A lot of folks that were too young to really participate in Occupy and, and also a lot of the Black Lives Matter stuff that was happening in 2014, like when we took the freeway on the night of the non-indictment. A lot of these folks were still in middle school and high school when that happened. So now they're just coming of age and they're getting involved with this here. And a lot of this is, I was telling somebody else, this is almost like, political education school 101. It's very basic in a lot of ways. Certainly for somebody like me who's been at, who's been doing this since I was outraged back in 92 when those four officers were acquitted after beating up Rodney King on camera. And, one of the things I want folks to have a context of is that at that time, catching officers doing bad deeds on camera was rare. In fact, it was kind of unprecedented, because now you have them in your phone and, there's surveillance video everywhere. And it wasn't like that in the late 80s, early 90s. It just wasn't. And so I've been outraged and, fighting this system since back then. So a lot of new people are coming to this movement now. And so basically I've been just getting down there, talking to people, participating in different events. You know, I went on some of the bigger marches that Black Lives Matter Seattle King County has done. On the 19th, Wyking is throwing a Juneteenth march in the CD. I'll be going to that. I kind of come in there as kind of a, you know, as a, an instructor, if you will, as a teacher, if you will, somebody who's been doing this for a long time. And rather than come in there as the leader or anything like that, come in there as the advisor, come in there to provide some history, some context, and, you know, and also really to bring people together, you know, to really bring people together under a particular set of politics. Because there's a lot of folks, you know, there's all kinds of, you know, folks who jump on the mic and declare themselves effectively the leader. And we found out that two of those individuals were police informants, like right off the bat. There's others who come up there and, you know, I think have, you know, they see the festive atmosphere and they think this is like, you know, like one of our summer, we have Capitol Hill block party every summer, except for this year because of COVID. So some folks are getting the idea that that's what this is about. And it's not. It's not. We're doing serious, you know, political work over here, but at the same time, you know, we're trying to keep our sense of humor as best we can, and you know, our sense of camaraderie as best we can.
Right.
You know, that's why they're, you know, the alt-right, you know, they can walk right through the place with their arms and their flags and all that stuff, and people will, you know, will shun them. People will criticize them. But nobody puts their hands on them, because there's a lot of folks who are trying to, you know, they say the whole thing of, you know, be the change you want to see. So there's a lot of folks that's what they're on. They're like, well, I'm nonviolent, so I'm not going to be violent towards these people, you know. Now, I have some disagreement with that, given that these folks are proven terrorists, and there's folks coming from out of state who still have charges pending for assaults, vandalism, property destruction, theft, and all kinds of other things that they do in places like Oregon and California, you know. So that needs to be said, and that needs to be stressed, especially with Fox News, you know, literally doctoring pictures and video in order to stir up their base to show up over here with a weapon, you know. And that's been a consistent pattern since Trump has become president, is that he would say or do something, you know, to stir up the base, and they would go and, you know, go into their gun vault and go, you know, grab a firearm and, you know, go to a protest or to the Walmart or to a big outdoor event that they think is going to, you know, have a lot of, you know, minorities or LGBTQ people, and shoot the place up. I mean, you mentioned the statue being pulled down in New Mexico yesterday, and an alt-right individual coming in there with his gun and shooting a couple people. We had a similar incident in Seattle on the 11th, I believe it was. There's video of that, too. The guy drove right through a barricade, jumped out of his car, and shot one individual, a man by the name of Daniel Gregory. I heard he's still doing well. And it turns out that apparently that individual with the gun, not only did he make bail, but he is the brother of a Seattle police officer.
Wow. So it comes full circle. You know, Greg, we have run out of time here, and we appreciate you breaking down a lot of this history. We're going to talk to some of the younger people that are part of the CHOP later on this week, but I'm glad that you laid down some firm context in which we should view things, so we appreciate it. Any last words in 30 seconds or less?
In 30 seconds or less, well, I mean, keep the fight alive. And again, you know, reparations, self-determination, workplace democracy, and from each according to ability, to each according to need on a global scale. That's what's going to get you your defunding, and that's what's going to get you your freedom, justice, and equality in your lifetime.
There you have it. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back. Thank you.
Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at kboo.fm.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K2208.